Tarry here, where the stories never grow old, and you hear something new every time they are told and it comes clear. So tarry here, where it doesn't matter your age, and when we gather round the table, we all take the stage year after year. So tarry here.
To the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenedradio.org. I'm Fanny Crawford.
And I'm Stacy Okowski.
We're just synchronizing our clocks, but we are here. Our theme for today, Monday, November 21st, 2022, is The Strangest Story. And we actually have a couple of those for you. We are community radio broadcasting from Bolivar, West Virginia, Martinsburg, West Virginia, and Hagerstown, Maryland. And I want to start out by thanking Andy Offutt Irwin for introducing our show this morning, as he does every week with his original composition, Tarry Here. And I also wanted to mention November 28th, so next Monday will be a standalone session of Stories in the Round featuring Stasia Okowski and yours truly, Fanny Crawford, on the theme of joy, darkness, and light. And this is an experiment. It's a way to find out if we still have an enthusiastic paying audience for Stories in the Round at the Unitarian Universalist Church of Hagerstown, so that we can do another series and bring in out of town towers. So if you want more information about that session at 7 p.m. on November 28th, that's a Monday, you can reach me, Fanny Crawford, at Fenitsky, F as in Fred, A-N-I-T-S-K-Y, at hotmail.com, or you can call me on my cell phone at 301-730-1638. And find out how to get tickets. Tell us about your weekend, Mr. Z.
Oh, well, I had a nice quiet weekend at home by myself. Since Terry is in Utah, I'll be picking her up at Reagan National this afternoon at 3:10. And so I watched a lot of stuff on iPad. I watched some football, which was very unsatisfactory because teams that I was rooting for were losing. I watched the Steelers yesterday, who played brilliantly for a half of the first half of the football game. And then in the second half, it was like, okay, Stosh, now we're going to act as if you're all the football players out here, 81 years old, and you can't hardly walk and run. And you certainly can't catch a ball thrown by the quarterback, and we're going to just look awful. And boy, was I yelling at my TV. Finally, in the middle of the fourth quarter, I got up and went in the kitchen and fixed myself something to eat and just listened to the end of the game. I just felt so bad for the coach. He's never had a losing season. 17 years as a professional coach in Pittsburgh, he has never had a losing season. And boy, it looks like he's gonna have to pull a miracle in order to get enough wins by the end of the season to keep that record. But it doesn't look good because they just had. Oh. Anyway, that's the news for the day, the sports news. And today the World Cup started, and I don't think I'm going to get to see many of the games because they come on at strange times. And, you know, if you have any life at all, it's hard to, you know, set your alarm for 11:45 at night to get a game from Qatar.
And can you record them?
I don't think so, but I'm not sure. I'm going to try. The problem is, they're not on normal stations. You know, the television people of the universe have finally, I was going to use a bad word, of saying what they're doing to the paying customer. It used to be you bought a TV, plugged it in, got an antenna, fiddled with it, and then you could watch television. And that's all the cost was there. You're paid for electricity, of course. But now, these streaming services, you have to pay for cable or, you know, whatever, and you have to pay for everything you want to watch. You turn on the TV, it says, a subscription is necessary to see this. And that, and so I can imagine that how people who used to rely on television for some entertainment and information, how they can possibly get that anymore, because it costs a fortune to do. If you watch TV and if you're a sports fan and all, you got to pay for everything nowadays, besides your regular, you know, cable and stuff.
So, well, good luck with that, Stosh.
Oh, I know.
Get to watch the World Cup. That's going
to
be.
I would like to see the United States team play, because I have been one of their biggest detractors for years. They missed the last two World Cups. They haven't played, well, last one. They haven't played in a World Cup since 2018. No, before 2018, 2014, because they are terrible. The men's United States team have not been good in the World Cup. Compared to the ladies, the women are fantastic. They've won the World Cup number of times, and they're considered the best female team in the world. For some reason, the men have won one or two games in each World Cup that they qualified for, and the sports writers say, oh, that's good, the United States. That's terrible. There are 15-year-olds in Germany who could beat us.
All right.
And that's not even a completely male team.
Would you like to talk about the Speak Story series?
I'm not going to say anything. I'm not going to rant about that. I'm going to say that we're going to have our 12th storyteller on December 13th, Stina Fagerton of Tromsø, Norway. She's a performer and a teacher. She's collected ancient, unique fairy tales from three cultures that are part of her heritage: Sami, Ven, and Arctic Norwegian. Stina is the winner of the 2003 Northern Norway Cultural Award, and she was picked as the best storyteller at the 2011 International Storytelling Festival in Oslo. I am really excited to see her.
Is she going to be telling some of her stories in English?
I hope she is. Okay. Since I don't speak any of those other languages. I've been reading a lot about people doing stuff in other languages. In fact, one of the tales I really wanted to tell today, but I couldn't get it. I just couldn't get it prepared properly, was about the Navajo code talkers from the Second World War. The story is just wonderful. And it's just, for the first time, I finally understood why the Navajo code talkers were so important during World War II, and why they were so, why it was so hard to break the code. I've read stuff and heard stuff about them having a book, a guidebook, but I did research this past week, and the men who created these codes that no one could break never had a book. They didn't have a set of rules that said you got to do it this and this and this and this. And what they did was they gave out information over the, you know, over the air, over the wires and stuff in Navajo. And they used the Navajo language, which no one else in the world uses, only their people. And so they were the ones who were passing out the information about plans, battle plans, and what they were suspecting from the Germans and all this. And those stories, tales, whatever they were, information, were spoken in the Navajo language, which is not written. And so they didn't have like a dictionary that they were using. It was all memorized, learned, and studied. And they would say Navajo words that then could be related to English words that would spell a word. You know, they would, and it would be like, and they were not consistent. So that they might say four Navajo words or three with four different parts or something that would translate into the English according to this code of, say, they. So they would speak in Navajo, and that would translate into four English words that somebody who knew what they were doing could piece together as, oh, that's T-H-E-Y. That's what those words are representing. And in the next sentence, they might use that again, but they wouldn't use the same Navajo words. So even if somebody caught and said, oh, I think that means the word they, the next time the word they was used, they would use four different Navajo words to stand for the same T-H-E-Y. Anyway, it was... I couldn't get my head wrapped around it enough to tell the whole story. I hope maybe in the future I will. And I've looked at the library and requested the book, Code Talker, so that I can learn it better. But I just think it's brilliant.
Well, that's something to look forward to.
Yeah. And it didn't involve a machine or anything written down.
Right.
You know? I mean, they may have had scratch pads where they were writing notes for themselves on both ends of the conversation through the air, but there was no printed material that somebody could get a copy of so that they could study it. It drove the enemy crazy, and enabled the war effort in a positive way.
I will look forward to hearing that story, and we'll have to think of what our theme is for that day. For today, I'm going to start with my strangest story, if that's okay. Mm. Are we ready for that?
Yes.
Okay. Well, the strangest story for me is my own development as a storyteller. And this was an interesting thing for me to put together because I did have to bring in a lot of different strands. So we'll see how this goes. Maybe the most important factor pushing me to document and tell stories is my own family history. My mom was a librarian, as you know, Stash. She was an archivist with a passion for history and literature. The history and great works of ancient and modern times in many different cultures and regions of the world, but in her later years, especially for American history and the ways that ordinary people from many different walks of life record or pass on what they experienced. Now, my dad considered himself a working man and a labor organizer, attuned to interests and passions of other working people. He had a working man's appreciation for the humor inherent in American politics and social commentary. So both my parents were interested in their own personal family history, going back generations, simultaneously unique and representative of life in the U.S. The earliest stories in my life were my dad's stories about his grandfather, who was a barber in upstate Pennsylvania and Western New York, and his great-great-grandfather, who escaped out of slavery in Maryland and became a successful self-employed Pennsylvania gardener and seed man. He was growing and selling plants, vegetable and flower seeds, on his own small plot of land and hiring himself out to his neighbors as a skilled horticultural practitioner. Now, that story is one that many of our radio listeners have heard me tell about that man, Henry, my great-great-grandfather, taken from his home on a Virginia plantation at a very young, very tender age, taken so young that as an adult, he could barely remember his own mother. He did not even know her name. There was a quilt she gave him when he was taken from her, intending that he would remember at least something of where he came from, a quilt that she made. That story is so embedded in both of my physical and emotional self, my physical and emotional being, that from my own teen years and into the present, now these days, I feel compelled to share that story with the next generation of my own family and to children everywhere who want to know what it must have been like to grow up in another far distant time and place. And the generation following Henry, was his son, my great grandfather, Thomas Henry Barnes. Thomas Henry Barnes is the honored patriarch of my father's generation. He was my father's grandfather, mainly because he committed to print. Thomas Henry Barnes wrote down the story of Henry's escape from slavery and everything that he gathered from his father about his early life, and then added his own later stories, Thomas Henry Barnes' own life stories. And those stories had great impact for my dad and my dad's brothers and sisters and their children. Now, I tell Thomas Henry Barnes stories, including the burning of the New York Colored Orphans Asylum in Manhattan during the New York City draft riots of the Civil War, the summer that those orphaned and now homeless children spent living outdoors on Blackwell Island in the East River after escaping the murderous racist rioters, those children's experience with typhoid fever, whooping cough, and other ailments that just decimated the population of those 300 children. They lost 20% of those orphan children the following winter through disease and accidents. Now, I tell those stories because I can't avoid them. They're my present day immersion in history. The early emotional impact of those stories on me just compels me to share those stories from my great grandfather and my great great grandfather as if they were my own. From my mom, I heard stories of her Jewish ancestors, members of a Jewish Masonic order in New York City, of her mother's experiences in Depression era New York with birth control, the strategies that worked effectively and those that did not, so that my mother and my Aunt Irene, they're just 18 months apart or 18 months between their birthdays, became surrogate mothers to my Uncle Hank, their baby brother, who was born a full decade later. Both of my parents served in the Army in World War II. So growing up, I heard stories about their experiences in that war. My dad in the Pacific Theater, primarily during and after the battle for the island of Saipan, and my mother working mostly out of Camp Shelby in Mississippi. Their stories were certainly richer, more nuanced, just plain different than what I heard in school about World War II. My dad served with Black troops, many of whom saw similarities between their own history and their experiences with Japanese prisoners of war they met on the Pacific Islands. My mom worked with returning soldiers, returning stateside. She administered Rorschach tests to traumatized troops and saw much of what is now referred to as PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. So I was learning about those types of casualties at the same time that we were hearing about similar casualties from the Vietnam War. Thomas Henry Barnes, my father's grandfather, helped raise my dad and most of his seven siblings, dozens of his cousins. T.H. Barnes was an avid reader of African American magazines, newspapers, books, both fiction and nonfiction, and I've inherited some of his books and other print materials. When my dad became a book dealer while I was a young teenager, and continued that pursuit in partnership with my mom for almost 30 years, I was exposed to a lot of those books, both the ones that were in my dad's collection that came to me much later, and also things that were being published at that time through the 50s, 60s, and later. Thomas Henry Barnes, my great-grandfather, often engaged his kids and his grandchildren, including my dad, in conversations about what he was reading. So my dad grew up hearing the words and opinions of Frederick Douglass, of W.E.B. Du Bois, James Weldon Johnson, Langston Hughes, and many others. I have a copy of a letter from T.H. Barnes to W.E.B. Du Bois on the matter of a subscription to the Crisis magazine, Du Bois's magazine, that T.H. Barnes was ordering as a prize or an incentive for a local schoolgirl in Olean, New York, who aspired to a college education. And he was talking about this young woman to W.E.B. Du Bois and asking for a subscription to the Crisis for her. Early on in my appreciation and desire to tell some of these stories, I created a timeline or a chronology for the life of my great-grandfather, T.H. Barnes, Thomas Henry Barnes. From the earliest ancestral date that he recorded, the birth of his mother's father, my great-great-great-grandfather, followed by the presidential election that he described in detail from 1856 that he remembered experiencing as a seven-year-old, continuing with the deaths of his parents, and he and his brother being rescued by his mother's brother, Uncle Peter, and then his education funded by that uncle. His uncle enrolling him at the New York Colored Orphans Asylum that I mentioned earlier. Other specific events of the Civil War that he records in his manuscript, and the aftermath of the war, specific personal history of his own, his apprenticeship to a barber, meeting Frederick Douglass, his marriage to my great-grandmother, her family history, the birth of their children, moving from Pennsylvania to the southern tier of New York State, his own membership and devotion into the Union League in Western New York, to several different churches, and to the Frederick Douglass Monument Committee and that memorial that he helped fund in Rochester. Now, more recently, I've started similar timelines or chronologies for each of my parents and for my mom's sister, Anne Irene. I'm inspired to badger my elders on both sides of the family for more family stories. From Aunt Iris, who's been gone now for several years. She died, I think, maybe 5 years, 6 years ago. She was my dad's sharp-tongued youngest sister. And I remember her tattling on my own cousins. She stayed at my house 3 days and never bought me a lick of groceries or a cup of coffee. She wouldn't buy a starving man a potato chip. And lots of other stories like that, leading me to wonder what Aunt Iris might have told my cousins about the pilgrimages we, my mom, my dad, and us kids, made to her house every summer for almost 20 years. Then there are the reports from Daddy's distant cousins, the current Barnes elders, reminiscing about his mother, Mabel Cinderella, my grandmother, T.H. Barnes' only daughter. Those now elder cousins call her Aunt Mabel. Well, when I knew her, she must have been in her 80s by then. She'd become a minion of Satan, sitting in the back of the Baptist church with the little children. We'd just come from Sunday school. She'd cause havoc, get us in terrible trouble, mutter funny comments during the pastor's homily, or change the words of the hymns to funny rhymes, all just under her breath. We could not stop giggling in the back of that church to save our lives. My mom hauled me out of church by an armpit. No one ever said a word to Aunt Mabel. Grown-ups just didn't know that side of her. And my mother's sister, Aunt Irene, who ran a weekly bingo bus from Brooklyn to Miami for 20 years, inspiring me to pass on her lessons in crowd management and marketing as a story about the Ten Commandments of the bingo bus. Thou shalt not steal thy neighbor's lucky seat. Thou shalt not distract the driver by asking for change while she's driving. Thou shalt not take the caller's name in vain. Thou shalt not threaten to kill the caller. Thou shalt not steal to feed thy gambling drones. Thou shalt not brag about how much thou hast won. Thou shalt not whine about how much thou hast lost. Thou shalt not call false bingo, etc., etc. It's probably time for me to create a more contemporary version of my own noteworthy dates and memorable anniversaries and sequence of events in my own life. You know, maybe sometime in the misty future, one of my nieces, my daughter, my stepson, or even my now teenage second cousins once removed will someday delight in cataloging and satirizing my own mean accomplishments, foibles, faults, and faux pas. After all, life and stories just get stranger with time.
Wow. It was interesting. There was something you said in there that struck me only because I'm an ignorant person, ignorant in the sense that I don't know everything I think I would like to know. You said in one of your sentences, and this is not a criticism, this is truly, I'm trying to figure out something here. Oh, by the way, your story was, that was 15 minutes.
That's good. That's what I thought it was going to be.
There you go. Well, you're on the clock a lot. So you do. But in a sentence you said, and I think I heard this correctly, a Jewish Masonic temple.
Yes.
Okay. I did not know those two words could go together.
Well, I didn't either.
I thought Masons were Christian people.
Well, when I was in my early, well, up until I was a young adult, the only Masons I knew about were white Masons, Christians, and Black Mason Christians, because there are several temples in Philadelphia. And my dad would always point out the Black Masonic Temple in downtown on Broad Street when we would go by that. And so, of course, I asked lots of questions. What's a Masonic temple? So I knew a fair amount about Prince Hall and the Black Masons. And by extrapolation, I knew some things about the white Masons. But I had no idea that there were Jewish Masons until my mother pulled out all these family documents and showed me photographs of the Jewish Masons in New York City and told me about her great uncles and her great great uncles. They had been Masons for generations in England before they came to the United States. So, yeah, and I don't know very much historically about them. All I really know about them is the little bit of family history that my mom shared. So well, there's a lot more research to do.
I know there's I got to get another book. It's almost like saying the left-handed, right-handed people.
Yeah.
In my brain. So I need to do research and find out. And that's good, because I'll be learning something new. that'll be nice. Wow. Well, your family has lots of history.
We do. And we apparently write all of it down. We're that kind of stuffy people.
Well, I think that's wonderful. And if I could go back and start over again, I would be writing a journal every day or something, because I've lived a pretty interesting life, but nobody's going to know about it.
Well, you can still write down your memories.
I can. And every time I think I should start, I find some way to not do it. Because
until Terry comes home, you have the perfect opportunity to get a couple pages written down.
That is, this morning I have got some, I could do that. And I have made some notes and stuff. What I should do is just turn on the recorder and start talking.
That's a great idea. That would be fun.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll come and interview you sometime.
Boy, that would be fun. Anyway, I guess I better tell a story.
Well, let's tell our listeners that this is the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour. We are an internet community-based station, and this is the Enlightened Radio Story Hour.
Okay. Well, when I was going to say, when you told me what the theme was going to be, however I suggested the theme.
Say that again?
I said, when you told me what the theme was going to be, I started looking around for stories. But then I thought to myself, wait a minute, I was the one who came up with this.
Yes,
this
you
idea.
Were. I did not I tell you what the theme was going to be. You told me what the theme was.
I know. See, when you live by yourself, and we did this since Thursday, I think. Anyway, that's in my mind. When you live by yourself like I did, I really did a lot of reflecting this week about what it would be like to be my age. Because the last time I lived alone, I was in my 40s. That's when I started in my 40s. And I was different. But now that as a person who's 81 years old, I think this last 4 days, I got some insight into what it would be like to be an old person, old man, who lives alone. And I think I have a lot of connections with people and stuff, but I think it would probably be a very difficult life for many people. And I think it'd be a very difficult life for me, in that I'd have to be with myself all the time. And I see from your smiling face that you think that might be kind of interesting or fun, or maybe would get you to want to go running out the front door screaming. Anyway, it did cause me to think a lot about what it must be like for people who, as I was looking down the street, and I thought, I wonder if that guy ever gets anybody to talk to him. You know, there are some people I got to know a little bit, and the person lives by himself, and that must be a difficult thing. And I guess some people love it. Some people probably do real well by themselves. Anyway, so I went looking through my resources to look for strange stories. I didn't want to trust my own brain on this one. And I did find from a dear friend some stories that Laura Lovick Lindsay, a woman in Pittsburgh area that I met years ago, who would come to storytelling guild meetings, and she never told any stories, but And I joined that guild after she did. And I got to know her real well. And I liked her story. She was a writer. She is a writer. And she asked permission when she started coming to the guild meetings if she could read some of her stuff and get some reactions to it, because she didn't have anybody close by to do that with. And of course, storytellers are always real nice. And this group said yes. And I loved her stories. In fact, the first story she ever told or read, as soon as she finished, and there was people liked it and talked, I said, may I have your permission to tell that story? And we became friends over that question, because she said, you're the first person here who's ever asked to tell one of my stories. And since then, I've told her stories a couple times, because I like the way she writes. She has a kind of strange leaning in her stories. And I really admire that. So here goes. If I can budge up the tiniest bit, I'll be able to see them again. That's better. Now, I think that's the McEwen boy jumping. I remember his mother. Couldn't punctuate to save her life, but a whiz in math. Can't imagine she'd be pleased to see her own boy jumping off those useless old bridge supports. Same ones where her own brother drowned. A lot of them whooping and hollering, same as these boys. Smacked his head on the cement when he flipped, as I recall. But it wasn't what killed him. No. Mark, that's this one's name, Mark McEwen. He must have been about done with school now, maybe this past year. I could ask Mrs. Sherman if I could wake her up. She remembers these things, but it wouldn't be fair. She does so much for me. Useless old man that I am. Look at that sweet piece on her face. Bless her. She does surely deserve a bit of a nap, if anyone does. Must be close to supper time, though, if I'm reading that lowered sun right. And my, I'm getting hungry. Someone ought to put a stop to it. All this river swimming. I can't anymore, but someone ought to, though I suppose the kids these days need something to do around here with the town as good as shut down. Keeps them out of trouble. My Tom always said I worried too much. I suppose he was right. Old Barking Town. Never was much of a town. Not even when the mines were open. A few houses here and there, and those all but empty. Mrs. Sherman told me that the population of Barking was once as high as 502. It's on the sign when she drives in, but that must have been in its heyday. I don't think Barking can have seen so many people in years. We lost the Morrisons a year before last, off to grab Florida sunshine they were. It was the Kelsos the year before. Or was that 3 years ago? Oh dear, muddle-headed me. The Kelsos are still here, I think. It's the Kesslers that left. I can't get those boys out of my head. Now let me think, what year was it when the four boys drowned? 81 or 82, I should think. Reagan was in the White House then, early days still for him. My, that was a sad summer around here. Do you remember the terrible summer, Mrs. Sherman? Mrs. Sherman? There I am again. I forget myself. So sorry. You go ahead and sleep, dear. Bit cold for these boys to be swimming in the Allegheny, I should think. September, is it already? October? I think it might be just be October. Some of the leaves are starting to change. Must be an Indian summer. Maybe Mrs. Sherman will prop the window open for me when she's up. It's a pity we never signed on for that Meals on Wheels. I do so hate the idea of disturbing poor Mrs. Sherman for supper. I didn't plan to get old. Funny to watch it happen. Dear Mrs. Sherman's not much better off. I'm the only family she has now. just the two of us in the world. Bless her heart. She brings herself every day to sit here by me. The only one who does now. I don't think she even went home last night, truth. I think it's as good for her as it is for me. Her own young ones left for the city years ago, years ago. All these memories just start swirling again like the leaves there on the hillside. Windy it must be out there. Well, my mind might not be much, but my eyes are as sharp as ever, and those boys are still chumming. Now, why do they do that? Why won't the McEwen boy stay away from those cement pillars? You would think his mother would have told him. Maybe she didn't. I never did hear them talk about the thing behind the pillars, the thing that bobbed and floated, the thing that watched. Now, why was that? I held my tongue. I figured the sheriff held his information back sometimes. I know they do that in their investigations, and thought maybe I'd just keep it quiet for him, too. One of my best students, there he was protecting us all. He was a good boy, college, married, two little girls of his own. Oh, slipping away. I'm losing it again. I've got to try to hold on to it this time. The boys, it was something to do with those boys down there. Mark McEwen, he's one of them. It was his uncle got taken under after he jumped. That was it. Mrs. Sherman, do you remember when that last McEwen boy's uncle drowned? Mrs. Sherman, he drowned. No, he didn't drown. He didn't drown, but everyone thought he did. He hit his head when he jumped. I saw it from here, but it wasn't that killed him. It was that thing hid behind those pillows. It was floating like driftwood. Maybe it even hung to a piece of driftwood. I can't recall, but it ducked under the water just as that boy hit the water, all bloodied. I wasn't sure what it was, though my eyes are as good as ever. I never had cataracts like Mrs. Sherman or my Tom, no. Now, that looks like McEwen boy down there. I wonder why someone doesn't stop those boys jumping off there. Don't they know the danger? Don't they know those boys were baking all those years ago? My, but it was hungry. Never told anyone. It was the sheriff's right to hold back what he wanted. Took them all. One, two, three, four, as they jumped. Why did they keep jumping? They were looking for fun, looking for the first boy, the other McEwen boy. They saw him hit his head, and then they were in the water, too, looking for him. Not a one of them ever came up again. Sheriff found their clothes, shoes. I think the story in the paper said it was the undercurrent pulled them all under. They never found the body. Not a bone, because it had been hungry. Hungry. Did we have breakfast? I can't remember. I don't think Mrs. Sherman is getting up again. And that's a shame. It's a shame because he is down there again. I think he's been there all afternoon, hiding there behind the rocks, watching them boys jump. It's moving now. Oh, it's moving. Someone needs to warn those boys there. Something's in that water.
Wow. That's quite a story.
Isn't it? That is, I like that so much because the first time I read that, I read it, I believe, I think I read it, at least, I know I read it at least twice. Yeah, right after the first time, I read it two more times. And then I started to think. I was sitting by myself just thinking about how what Laura does with her writing. I like her story so much because on the surface, they sound a little bit prattled sometimes. But the speaker in that story is going back and forth. After I read that the third time, I realized what that story was doing. It was going back and forth. This old man looking out the window, and he was seeing people now, and he was also seeing images from years before. And maybe he was even one of those boys jumping off those pilings. But when he mentioned something that's floating on top of the water and how that was always there and how those boys disappeared, they never found any of their anythings. Anyway, it gave me a real creep. and I like it. I told that's one of the stories that I told at a Halloween gathering once. And when I finished, it got a response, the kind of response that I like. There was not a sound at first. And then after about 25, 30 seconds, there were a whole lot of sounds. Like, oh my God. Oh, what? And applause, because people started to realize just what the words were telling them. So that's from my friend Laura Lovett Lindsay.
Laura Lovett Lindsay?
Lovett, yeah. Laura Lovett, L-O-V-I-C, V-I-C, and it's hyphenated with L-I-N-D-S-A-Y. And she writes, and this is from a book she published called Tales the Crows Taught Me.
That's a great title.
Oh, yeah. It's wonderful. And some of her stories are scary. One or two of the stories I've read in this, it's a small book of paperback, but one of the stories I read, I had to put it down a couple of times before I finished it. Because it was, you know, it was very disturbing, her descriptions. And she deals in some strange ideas, scary ideas, but and the very strange ones.
Huh. Does she do readings?
Pardon?
Does she do story readings of her work?
Oh, I believe she does. She attends lots of writing things, and I tried a couple just for fun. She has, we've kept in touch, and she's reminded me about writing things come up. She's been with a group that sends out a prompt, and you have a certain number of hours to get a story to them, you know, and sometimes there's a 1,000 words, no more than 1,000 words or something like that. And sometimes the prompts are kind of odd. I just came across one that was sent by somebody else, just in general, to a site on Facebook. And it was a challenge to write a story of less than 250 words. And I thought, oh, that's one of those things old man Stosh can't do. It takes me 250 words to tell people who I am. So anyway, but I do enjoy her stories because they make me think, and because they're scary in lots of ways. She'd be a lot of end of life stories, I think.
So that's one of her regular themes.
Yeah, and I have told one or two of her stories before on the radio. And one of them has a labyrinth in it, which I told shortly after I met you, or shortly after I had been to Stories in the Round, one of her stories that I told, it wasn't at Stories in the Round, but maybe sometimes I will tell that one also. That takes a little bit more work.
Well, that was a great story, and I will see if I can find her books.
Yeah. And
Does she write in any other genre, or that's her pretty?
That's short, pretty short much, I think, stories. That's what she does. She writes a lot in ghosts, and she's part of a writer, a group that, you know, works on their writing in it. But I think her favorite is stories with a strangeness to them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I appreciate her writing because you can't always tell where the story is going or why it started where it did and why it's, you know, until you get to the ending. And just recently, I wonder if I share something with you. Do you know who Arthur C. Clarke is?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. One of my favorite authors. I've read a number of his books. Of course, he's gone now, but also one of my favorite ever books that was turned into a movie, 2001, A Space Odyssey. I came across in one of these personal libraries in front of a person's house. You know, people put books in a little box and right. everything. And, uh-huh. and some people are doing such a nice job with that because they make the box be look like a little house or something that's right. neat. Anyway, I picked up this book, was old, and it has a novel in it and 17 stories. Short stories, and some of them are on the light side and some of them are on the scary side. But something I've gotten to appreciate from his short stories, which I don't think I've ever read any short stories by him before this, is that I explained this to my wife, and at first she just stared at me, and then I said, I think I have to, I'll read you the end of a story. And then you'll see what I mean, because his stories aren't very long, 5-6 typewritten pages, you know, maybe 8 if it's a long one. But the kind of gut punch in the stories are the last line or two. If you did not have the last line or two, it would drive you crazy. Because you wouldn't know what the whole point of it was. And I have enjoyed that so much. I've had in the back of my mind, I might have used one of those stories today. But it's just wonderful. He writes, you know, 5 or 6 pages. It's got to be maybe 2,000 words. And the story is going on and on. You're wondering what's this about? And then the last sentence or two is really like a kick in the stomach in some. and in some, it's like a good pat on the head. It's, you know, it's a kind of happy ending, but some of the ones that are not a happy ending are just, I mean, I finished the first one I just sat back and said, oh my goodness, how'd he do that? Because he just had me so interested in the whole thing, and the ending was such a kick. So anyway, what I thought when I finished reading the rest of these stories, I think I've read out of 17, I think I've read 13 of them, but when I finished them, I thought I would pass this book on to you. And
oh, okay.
And I thought Fanny would probably like this. It's an old book. It's interesting, it's written a number of years ago and published, but it mentions things that people were working on. And the first thing that caught my eye was it mentions computers that are being run by tubes. Mm. And when I was in the Army I went in the Army in 1959, and when I was in Germany, and I left Germany in 62, I worked with radars, and I became the guy who ordered all the parts for the radar vans and stuff. And the parts mostly that I was ordering were hundreds of different tubes, because in those days there were no such things as these little chips and diodes and all that stuff. The computer that ran our radar system was housed in a van, a long van, about 40 feet long, and had 5,000 tubes. And those tubes burned out easily. Our maintenance men had to do 2-hour checks, 4-hour checks, 8-hour checks, 12-hour checks, and 24-hour checks. And I was in charge of ordering the tubes, cataloging them, keeping them in the right place in the supply van. And then as soon as a tube burned out, I had to put that on my list to order from the supply person at Spangdahlem Air Base, which was 105 kilometers away, and which I drove to 3 times a week to pick up, 3 times a week to pick up new tubes. And it was a pleasant trip because I would go there to the air base. There was Army outfits and an Air Force outfits. And I would go there, and because I was in military, even though I was not in Air Force, I could go to the Air Force mess hall. Their food was 10 times better than the Army's. And at every meal, they had wonderful desserts.
Well, I'm interested in the part of your story about those very old computers, because yesterday, while I was at the Unitarian Church, I overheard an older woman telling about getting into the world of computers very early, right about 1990, because her son was studying computers at that point and brought home these early machines. So they had a computer in their house as a personal computer very early. And I thought that would make an interesting, strangest story. You've just reminded me about what a great story that would be to start out with all those tubes and how complex the maintenance of those machines was, and then moving ahead to the current day. But the point of her story was that she really feels like she has not kept up. She used to be very pleased with herself for having these machines and being able to run them. But now everything is just a big pain because she doesn't have the patience or the time to invest in learning the latest iterations, and things change so fast. You know, the applications change so fast. The upgrades that come to you, whether you want them or not, and discombobulate all your system and all your systems and all your documents, all of your records, can get really screwed up if you're not doing things according to protocols.
And the new phones have gone beyond. The phones, you can take a picture, of course, you know this, with your iPhone. And it just boggles my mind that I loved, when I was in college, I bought a Super 8 camera to record video on film. Mm-hmm. And I could get film that would last almost 12 minutes. Then I had to mail it away. And then wait a week and a half until it came back, and then I had to have a projector to thread the film in and all that stuff. And also, even with the early Kodak and all these camera people, you could buy a camera where you could take, I think some of them went as much as maybe 12 or 16 pictures. And they were in a cardboard box like camera, and then you could take that to a store that dealt in it, and they would mail that away, and they would get you prints of those pictures. So, now, I just looked this morning. I have over 8,500 pictures in my iPhone. Lots of them that are just strange. In fact, I look at him sometime and I think, why do I have a picture of that woman? Because, you know, there's just a picture. And at the time I took a picture of somebody because it was interesting. And when I started making notes about those pictures, I realized I should never keep a picture unless I know what it's about. Because somebody's going to think I'm really strange. Anyway.
Wow. We could go on, couldn't we?
I tend to do that.
Well, it is time to end the show, according to my clock. So I'm just going to say, this is Fanny Crawford.
And Stosh Ziolkowski.
Your co-hosts for the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenedradio.org, independent community radio broadcasting from Bolivar, West Virginia, Martinsburg, West Virginia, and Hagerstown, Maryland. And we are closing out the week's show. We're offering listeners a window into the world of telling by traditional and non-traditional tellers, encouraging you, our listening community, to share, preserve, and expand all of our stories. John, what's up next?
The blues.
Blues.
From Australia.